Be delighted, Karen, if you just had Katie doing full on attack.
This is the best team I've seen in weeks. Get her over there.
Subscribe to the Koi Gig podcast stream on the OTB Sports app now.
Off the ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.
So I think we're all just about coming down off the high that Sunday's Formula One finale gave us. The interest levels in the sport have probably never been higher thanks to Drive to Survive. And one Irishman, well, you might have spotted him on Drive to Survive, has been right there pit side over the last few seasons. And I'm delighted he is with us now. Patrick Harding, how are you?
Yeah, really good. Thank you for having me on.
Performance coach for Alec Albon, who's on his way back into Formula One next season, had a year out of it after a couple of years there, which is where people might have seen you on Drive to Survive. Were you around the circuit this year at all?
Yeah, I was there a little bit. Alex was a reserve this year, so he travelled to the majority of the races, and there was a few where he did some tyre testing after the race weekend. So for those race weekends, I was there, yeah. So it was nice to dip my toe back in. But I was working in Formula 3 this year, which is 7 races on the same circuits and the same race weekends as F1. So I got a little sense of the buzz again. It was nice.
Your background, a lot of it's in physiotherapy. You worked with the Arsenal Academy. You were with Team GB at 2012 and 2016 Olympics. You were with Sydney University around the AFL. How did you move from physiotherapy into becoming a performance coach? Which I would imagine is more on the mental side of the game.
Yeah, absolutely. So while I was at Arsenal, I did a master's in strength and conditioning just to kind of bolster my skills from a physio point of view, but also to have a little bit more understanding around training load and how that affected players and people that I worked with. And just around that time, I got approached by Michael Conlon and Paul Dunn, the golfer, just to help them out individually with some work that they were trying to do at the time. And what I started to do was really enjoy the level of detail that you could get into individual athletes compared to trying to manage a squad, which you would at Arsenal, of 25, 30 players. And that kind of really sparked my interest in the individual side. And then an opportunity came up in motorsport, which afforded me the opportunity to make that full time. And exactly like you said, you know, I think you quickly realize in elite sport that, you know, the majority of people competing at that level have the technical ability, and what it's really about is execution under pressure. So I went back and did my mental performance qualifications a couple of years ago. And I guess what I do now is put that skill set of physiotherapy, S&C and mental performance coaching around elite individual athletes. And I guess the terminology is performance coach, but that's what it is really, is just combining those skill sets in trying to support these individuals to grow.
I hadn't realised you'd been involved with Paul Dunn, and like, golfers are perhaps the most interesting of all sports people when it comes to working with psychologists, and Patrick Harrington's work with Bob Rotella and various different people throughout the years. With Paul Dunn, whenabouts did you start working with him?
So I worked with Paul, actually, I mean, probably from the end of his first year as a pro until probably about 2 seasons on. So I was with him when he had the BMW Masters win, and yeah, he had some really good top 10 finishes. And I think what you saw with Paul over the last few years is just a young guy in professional sport adapting to the lifestyle, adapting to the demands. And, you know, what we do see with individuals, a lot of individuals of his age, is, you know, you get peaks and troughs of performance. And he seems to be coming back pretty well now, and hopefully he'll find some consistency in his game and get back to where he was before.
Yeah, here's hoping. So in terms of Formula One and your work with Alex Albon, are you employed by the Red Bull racing team, or are you employed by the driver himself?
So initially it was through the Red Bull racing team, but that was specifically with Alex, and I actually moved from Formula 2 to Formula 1 with Alex. Now that we moved to Williams, it's 50-50, so it'll be 50% with Williams and 50% with Alex. But what tends to happen with performance coaching in F1, kind of like golf and caddies, although they're very different roles, is that you move with the driver. So you move teams kind of wherever the driver goes, you go. So yeah, I'm looking forward to a little bit of a change of scenery next year and see what it's like at Williams.
Yeah. In terms of what you do with an individual like an Alex Albon, on the outside you would look at Formula 1 drivers and think, confidence wise they all look absolutely bulletproof. To get to the absolute pinnacle of your sport, to take the risks that they take, there can be no room for doubt. I guess there'd be no need for you if there was no doubt, though.
Absolutely. And again, you look at that young generation of Formula 1 drivers: Lando Norris, George Russell, Alex Albon, Charles Leclerc, you know, Nicholas Latifi to a certain extent, those guys all came up, Pierre Gasly, they all came up together through karting. So there's quite a familiarity there. And we have an assumption about professional athletes that just because they're in that environment, like you said, they're bulletproof. But actually what you see with that group is a group of young individuals who have been in the bubble of motorsport for the majority of their adult lives. And they actually don't get the exposure to, I guess, normal environments that we would have, where we've developed their emotional strategies. And actually, sometimes they're the ones who need even more support because they haven't had that exposure. So while they're very confident and competent in their technical application, a lot of the work, like you said, is supporting them through the pressures of being in a sport where there's only 20 places on the grid in the world. And actually the media scrutiny and the level of people kind of, I guess, getting involved in your lifestyle is through the roof compared to any other sport in the world. So, you know, you just have to look at the fallout after the Verstappen and Hamilton tussle at the weekend. You know, it's all over the world. And at times during Alex's Red Bull career, you know, he was on the front and back pages of newspapers. And that's a difficult thing for a young guy to handle. So a lot of the time, that's what you're really supporting him with.
From the outside, it seems as though a lot of them would be very similar personalities, though, that they would be that more type A personality where they're incredibly focused, incredibly ambitious and competitive. Is there room for different types of personalities on the grid when you get to that high level, or does everybody need to actually have a similar sort of set of characteristics?
I think what you find is that each of those drivers has a very specific drive, an emotional drive, not a physical drive, but an emotional drive that has been the driving force for them to get to that point in their careers. They've obviously also had the technical ability to support that. And some of them have also had billionaire fathers, but that's a different story. But they will all have certain elements that will have gotten them to that point. They all absolutely have different characteristics in terms of their personality. You know, you take somebody like Alex and George, who are best friends, you know, it's safe to say, and I would say to George himself, he loves the media, he loves the spotlight, he loves getting his picture taken. Alex is the complete opposite, even though they're best mates. He doesn't like being in front of the camera. If all he had to do was drive, then it would be the perfect job for him. So even though there's similarities in terms of what makes them successful, their individual personalities can differ quite a lot. And even if you talk about cross sports, and I work with Michael Conlon, I've been working with Michael since he turned professional. Alex and Michael couldn't have come from two different backgrounds and exist in two different worlds in terms of their sport. But actually, there's a real understanding between the two of them around what makes them successful. And with that, there's a real bridge in that friendship, and they get on like a house on fire, even though they shouldn't. So I think with professional sports people at that level, they recognize the traits in other sports people that makes them successful. But there's definitely room for individual characteristics there.
I'm sure your work with Alex, considering you seem to spend so much time with him, it's almost a 24/7 gig at times, is built around the entire life package in terms of getting optimum performance throughout the week and picking moments to relax, picking moments to be intense. How much of your work is spent on the 90 minutes of the race, or the 2 hours from when he first sits into the car to when the race finishes? And what sort of process do you want him to go through from sitting on the grid to the lights going off to actually the mindset he has when the race is on?
Yeah, so look, at that point, all of physical preparation is done. So he's fueled, he's had the right nutrition on board, he's had his physical preparation to actually physically be in the car. At that point, we'll have done a lot of work in breaking that first part of that race down into segments. And what we'll do is work on visualization for each of those segments of that race. So if you even take the start procedure, so we'll have visualizations for a start procedure, his procedure off the grid, you know, his options of plan A, plan B, plan C down at the turn one. You know, he'll work through scenarios where he's on the left side of the grid, right side of the grid, what the cars in front do. And actually probably one of the key elements of any race weekend is getting around turn one with your car intact. And then it's about, okay, what is your overall strategy from a team perspective? And that might be to do with your tires. So is it a case of, right, you've got soft tires, you've got two or three laps where you can make up some positions, so let's get after the cars in front? Or is it a case of, okay, you're going to go along on this set of tires, you need to maintain that position that you've got and try and manage those tires as best you can for the next 5 or 6 laps? So we'll probably have 15 to 20 different scenarios that he'll use visualization to work his mind through them, so that in those split seconds when different things happen on the grid, especially into turn one, he's already had that mental process of how he's going to react to that, and he's already worked through the solution. Now, when he gets past that first two or three laps, the racer and Alex comes out, and actually what his biggest strength is he is a racer. He's a Sunday guy, you know, so probably the biggest part of his development was on Saturday and in qualifying. Actually, once we've worked through those first two or three laps, I know he's exactly where he needs to be, and his own technical ability and that natural racer in him takes over, and that stuff, you know, is all him. And like I said, that's probably the strongest aspect of his technical ability.
Yeah, and that natural racer is obviously something you never want to lose. And
absolutely.
I'm thinking back to a panel we had last Saturday ahead of the final race in Abu Dhabi, and John Watson and David Kennedy were two of the guests, and talking about driving in the 60s and 70s and how at that stage sort of death was always on your shoulder, that it was something you were always aware of, and their friends were dying. It was such commonplace. Drivers these days, like, in terms of fear, do you want them to be fearless? Do you want them going on the track fully aware of the dangers? How do you approach that side of it?
Look, it's you, and we talk about it a lot with Alex around driving with controlled aggression, and that's very different to being reckless. So it's about making aggressive decisions at the right time. And that again comes back to technical ability. And there's been a lot of chat around Max about how aggressive he is when he drives. That's his driving style. He's always driven like that. You know, when he turned into Formula One driver initially, you know, the media used to call him Verstappen because he had so many knocks. But it's about learning when to take those risks and when not to. I think they all respect the speed that they drive at. And unfortunately, accidents still do happen. You know, look at Jules Bianchi a few years ago. And unfortunately, look at Antoine Hubert in Formula 2 a couple of years ago in Spa. You know, that was Alex's first race weekend at Red Bull. So unfortunately, they understand, and obviously look at Roman.
How does the conversation go with Alex after a weekend like that?
You know what? You don't get to that level without having a few accidents. And Alex has had a couple of big shunts. And I think once you've had a few, they really understand how safe these cars actually are. And like I said, you just have to look at Grosjean's accident in Bahrain last year to appreciate the level of safety that these cars actually carry. And they have, you know, ultimate confidence that when they are in that car, they're as safe as they're going to be. And Alex will laugh and say he's safer in his Formula One car than he is on the M1, because he knows everybody around him is, you know, at the level of driving that he is. So, yeah, look, you don't spend a lot of time talking about it because it's something that you don't necessarily draw attention to. That crash in Bahrain, you know, all the drivers were back in the pit lane and it was replaying on the TV. For all those guys, once they know that the driver is out of the car, then that's it. They've moved on already. And, you know, that crash happened. Alex came straight on the radio. He was in front of the crash. He'd come around the hairpin and look back up and just saw the ball of flames. And he came straight on the radio and he was like, who was it? Are they okay? By the time he'd got back around to the pit lane, we knew it was Grosjean. We knew he'd gotten out of the car. And that's it. Alex has moved on already. Once they know they're safe, then that's it's like a driver's code, you know. Is the driver okay? Irrespective of what rivalries you've got, is the driver okay? And once they know they're okay, then they're on to, okay, where am I on the grid? Is it going to be a safety flag restart? Is it a rolling start? What's the technical, you know? So, yeah, we don't spend a lot of time on it.
You mentioned there that the drivers, because they're all on the same level, there's that respect for each other. And people often look at Formula One and say, oh, it's not about the drivers now, it's about who has the best car. But then the best drivers get the best cars. When you are looking through that grid, what is it that separates the guys who are at the top of the grid from the bottom of the grid?
Probably a mixture of technical ability and natural racing skill. And look, you look at any sport, I think what highlights it even more is that, again, F1 is so condensed. There's 20 seats in the world. Whereas if you look at the Manchester City squad or the Liverpool squad, there's players on varying abilities, even though they're all professional footballers. And that's none different than it is in Formula One. You cannot argue that, you know, Lewis Hamilton and Max Verstappen are probably the two hottest drivers in Formula One at the minute. But in the right car, somebody like a Charles Leclerc somebody like a George Russell, somebody like a Lando, someone like an Alex, they could win a championship. So there's probably 8 or 9 drivers there that have the capacity to win the championship, but maybe aren't in a championship winning car. And I think that's what we saw this year with Max. You know, he's had 6 years in Formula One, you know, youngest ever driver to win a Formula One race. He won a Formula One race before he was allowed to drive a road car. He didn't have a road car license. And it was a bit of a case over the last few years of, well, when are Red Bull going to have a car that is capable of challenging Mercedes? And what we saw this year was a Red Bull car that was that was capable of challenging Mercedes. And then we had what we had last weekend, which was a race to the finish, which was, you know, incredible for the neutrals to watch.
I don't know if you could describe yourself as a neutral with that Red Bull side of things, but what was it like being around it over the last few weeks, the sort of rolling circus that is Formula One? How different was it compared to even when you started out in the sport? And yeah, just looking closely at Verstappen and Hamilton, it seemed just sort of as intense a sporting rivalry as you could get right now.
Yeah, 100%. And I think there was Max had huge momentum, and then in Brazil, when, you know, and Max probably should have taken another step forward, the race format over that race weekend with the sprint race and then the feature race on the Sunday really gave Hamilton an opportunity to, you know, take that grid penalty and get himself backed up and to win that race. It definitely felt like there was a bit of a shift of momentum back to Lewis in terms of, I guess, that confidence in the car and the car being in a place. And then the car itself found some incredible pace over the last few races. So I think it was like one of those classic boxing matches, you know, 12 rounders where, you know, each round a different fighter comes out swinging. And I think that's what you saw, which was two drivers probably, Lewis is going for his 8th world championship and Max is probably just hitting his stride in terms of what he's capable of. So it was a really incredible atmosphere in the garage and, you know, in the factory over the last few weeks. And I think, you know, irrespective of your opinions on what happened and Mike Massey and his calls, I think either driver deserved to win that championship. And
get off the fence, Patrick. Come on. What did you really think of Michael Massey's call?
Let's just say he's got himself a lifetime supply of Red Bull, that's for sure. But he had the right to make that call, but it was a very strange call. You either don't unlap any cars or you unlap them all. To choose the 4 cars in between Hamilton and Verstappen, unlap them and then go, right, safety car in, let's do this. And Max on fresh tires and Lewis on, what, 35, 40, 40 lap olds, hard tires. There was only going to be one winner. And I think that's the frustration. Although he had the capacity and the authority to make that call, it was a very strange call.
Yeah.
But I'm not complaining.
I'm sure you're not, and I'm sure nobody around Red Bull is. The interest levels are obviously off the scale, largely driven, it seems, by Drive to Survive. And I'm one of those people who's a lapsed Formula One nut and absolutely loved it during the Senna, Prost, Schumacher years and sort of drifted out and went along with that assumption that, it's all about the cars now, not about the drivers. Have you noticed, been around the grid, the impact that this title race and Drive to Survive has had? Does it feel like a rejuvenated, a changed sport?
Absolutely. And I think what it's done is brought in a new generation of fans that are younger, more clued into social media. You know, you just have to look at Twitch and, you know, the younger drivers' social media accounts and the level of followers that those guys have. And that's predominantly come through Netflix. I think what Sky Sports and Channel 4 can be guilty of at times is their commentary being so technical that can actually turn off the neutral. But what you do with somebody like with Netflix is, you know, and the reason that a lot of us follow football teams or we get invested in certain sports people is there's an emotional attachment there. We find it a little out about their story and we connect with that. And then suddenly we follow them and we're looking out for them. And that's exactly what Netflix did. It gave us an insight into these drivers as who they are as human beings. And actually some of the really difficult stories that some of them had, Alex included, in how they've gotten to Formula One. Obviously, there's some guys who have fast-tracked and that's why they're there. But, you know, for somebody like Alex or somebody like Esteban Ocon, you know, their journey to Formula One has been pretty incredible and they've had to fight through a lot of adversity to get there. So something like a Netflix gives us a little insight into that. And like I said, that has brought a huge new wave of followers, which is has been incredible. And then, like you said, you know, on the back of those first two or three seasons of Drive to Survive, you have a season like this season, which has been the best season for 12 years.
Yeah.
You know, Hamilton ran away with the championship last year by about 150 points. And then this year we've got two drivers coming into the last race of the season on exactly the same points. You know, it's like Netflix wrote the script themselves. So I'm sure people are hanging out for next season of Netflix already.
We're going to see a lot more of Alex Albon next season. I saw him even been interviewed after the race by Sky and talking about his move to Williams. Just briefly, could you give us the background where you talk about how he's had to fight to get to Formula One?
Yeah, look, there's a lot of stuff out there around Alex. You know, he started in karting at a young age, was funded by his parents. They fell into some financial difficulties at 15. He was dropped by Red Bull as a junior driver, had no funding, relied on his ability to get drives through single-seaters, Formula 4, Formula 3, Formula 2, you know, didn't have budget, but teams believed in him, gave him an opportunity. Came down to the last race of the Formula 2 season, and it was between Lando Norris, George Russell and Alex for the championship. George came out on top that race, but it looked like Alex was going to Formula E. And then he got a phone call from Helmut Marko, who said there was a seat at Toro Rosso and he wanted Alex in it. So, you know, at multiple times through Alex's career, it looked like that dream was over, including, you know, this time last year when Red Bull decided to go for a little bit more experience in Sergio Perez. And again, you know, you see that resolve and that resilience from Alex to fight his way back even this year again and you know, have a number of teams interested in him as a driver for next year. And that's just credit to him as an individual and him as a sports person and him as a driver. You know, he has a lot of stock in the paddock. And yeah, I think Williams is a good place for him next year. And I think with the new regulation changes, I think the gaps will be a lot closer. And with that Mercedes engine at Williams, I think they'll be strong next year.
Yeah, it is incredible how quickly it can turn in Formula One when you look at Sergio Perez. And it was a big part of last season's Drive to Survive, where it looks as though he's going to be out of the sport, and a little bit of luck in one race, and next thing he gets one of the prime seats in the sport, and
absolutely
on the final day of the season makes a huge impact in getting Max Verstappen the title. So when does prep start then? Because the interest levels are huge, everyone's going to be talking about it post-Christmas, building up towards March. In terms of your next few months and working with Alex Albon, what will you be doing?
Yeah, so I mean, we've been pretty much working away all this year, and our goal was to get him back in a seat for next year. So it's been a pretty continuous process. I guess the only thing for Alex, the only consideration for us from a training point of view, is the fact that he's not had a lot of time in a Formula One car this year. You know, he's done some tire tests and he's driven DTM, but they're very, very different. He's doing a lot of sim at the minute at Williams. And then early January, we're going to a 10-day training camp. And then it's all gone blazing. He'll have a lot of factory time between the middle of January and winter test in the middle of February. And once you hit winter test, it's really just a countdown until that first race of the season. So while you know, people are probably longing for next season's start, it'll come around pretty quickly, and it'll come around pretty quickly for Alex as well.
And when are you meeting the producers of Drive to Survive to make sure you get one of those starring roles next year?
Don't worry, I've got them on WhatsApp. I've already been messaging. No, it's, look, the Netflix guys are really good. You know, they embed themselves in the team really well. You know, you understand that they're around, but they're also really good about what they put in and what they don't put in. So, you know,
what don't they put in?
A lot of bad language and a lot of frustration. But they mic you up in the morning and you just forget the microphone is there. And suddenly you're having a conversation with somebody and you look around and there's a camera 10 meters away and you're thinking, oh, crap, they've got the audio and they've got the visuals, so they can use that. So you have to just try and scupper it as much as you can. But no, they're good guys, and you appreciate that they have a job to do. And you know, like we talked about already, you know, these sports rely on fans, and a series like Drive to Survive brings in huge amounts of fans, and that's what's going to keep the sport going.
I don't know if there's any other Irish people out there where you can do that old Irish thing of just speaking a bit of Gaelic when the camera's on, so they won't understand what you're doing.
Well, would you believe Nikita Mazepin's physio is Irish as well? A guy called Damien Kelly. He's a good lad. But obviously Nikita missed last weekend's race because he tested positive for COVID. So yeah, He's a good lad. You'd be surprised. There's a few of us around the paddock, not right. in terms of coaching, but there's a guy from Cork, Michael Manning, who is Max Verstappen's number three on a race day. So he's pretty high up in Red Bull, and he had a key component to Max's championship win this year. So.
All right. We might try and have a chat with him as well, I think.
Yeah, we get everywhere. Don't worry.
Yes, of course.
As you know.
Patrick, great stuff. Listen, very best of luck next season. Can't wait to see how Alex gets on and how you get on as well. And thanks a lot for joining us.
No bother at all. It's been a pleasure.
Off the ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.